Women have been playing football for more than 150 years, and it's always been political. Some have been celebrated, but others have been ridiculed, criticized, and forgotten. This is the Forgotten 11, the hidden history of women's football.
I'm not going to the White House. No.
You know, there was a lot of critics talking about us, but we're back, so it's not been that long.
Give me the effing ball.
Playing like a girl means you're a badass.
Hi, I'm Chris McGlynn. Welcome to the Forgotten 11, the hidden history of women's football. Today, I gotta say, I'm kind of blown away. I mean, I know a bit about women's football, but wow. Most episodes, I know the basics of the story. I just need to research the details and find a narrative, find a way to tell the story in some interesting way from usually meager documentation. Today, though, I found a story that I was not expecting, that I knew nothing about. I knew nothing about this story, so I hope I can do it justice. Also, with the lockdown, this podcast is my new main source of income. So, if you like the show, you can go to patreon.com/forgottenxai, or if you can't do that, follow the show on Twitter, share it with your friends, or on social media, and leave a review wherever you listen. Thanks a lot. In the 1800s, around the world, most children didn't go to school. And most of those who did, didn't go to school for a full 12 or 13 years. When a kid turned 12 or 13, they might go to work on a farm, selling newspapers, babysitting, or hundreds of other trades. But then, something happened. Machines. Machines that could make other machines. That could make cloth, that could make steam engines, machines that could harvest and process crops, machines that could multiply the efforts of a single worker hundreds of times. It was called the Industrial Revolution, and it changed a lot of things. But one of the most important changes is often overlooked. With these machines making thousands of times what a single worker had previously made, the nature of human labor changed. Workers needed to calibrate and maintain those machines. Workers needed to inventory the now thousands of items produced each day. In short, they now needed an education to be able to do their jobs. They needed schools everywhere around the world. Everyone needed to learn to read, to count, to do basic math. And well, a school is really just a building. What workers really need is teachers. Millions of them. In the mid and late 1800s, normal schools popped up around the world. Normal schools are what we would now usually call a teacher's college. Normal schools taught a lot more than reading and how to teach. The students at normal schools needed to be fluent in anything they might need to teach. Math, French, economics, philosophy, history, physical education, parenting, almost anything you can think of. Often a graduate of a normal school was considered educated enough to found their own school or college. As an example, the college I attended was founded in 1853 by two normal school graduates in a remote frontier town in Illinois. A normal school grad would literally ride into town, be given a building, and create a complete curriculum for the children or adults of the town. They were often the only book-smart people in town. If you were a normal school grad, it was kind of assumed that you knew more or less everything. What if you had an agenda? You could change a lot of people's minds. The reason I mention this is these normal school grads were something the world had never really seen before. Throughout the world, the vast majority of graduates from normal schools were women. Most colleges and universities around the world barred women, or at least made it very difficult for them. Normal schools not only admitted women, they often taught them more than what a Harvard graduate might have learned. In the 18 and early 1900s, millions of women were called on to all corners of the world to deliver the working class from ignorance. and to a large extent, they had near total control of what they chose to teach their pupils. These women, the founders of thousands of schools throughout the world, were not simply teachers. They traveled the world founding these schools, often in remote places. They were community organizers, public speakers. They were important members of the communities where they lived and worked, and they were politically active. One of those schools was called Liceo Número Uno de Niñas de Santiago, Chile, or Girls High School Number One of Santiago, Chile. Founded in 1895 by a woman named Juana Gremler. Gremler studied at a normal school in Germany. The curriculum she developed became a model for girls' high schools throughout Chile, Argentina, Peru, and to an extent, Brazil. One of the unique things about Gremler's curriculum was that it included a few hours a week for physical education, much more than similar curricula in other countries. Despite objections, Gremler lobbied for more resources for women's sports in schools. And she convinced other educators of the importance of physical education for women and girls. On the 19th of June, 1895, the Federación de Fútbol de Chile was founded, Chile's FA. Chileans fell hard and fast for football. The first evidence of women playing football in Chile comes from a photograph of eight women in school uniforms posing with a football in front of them. On the ball and in the caption is written, Team Talca de la Escuela Normal, or Team Talca of the Normal School. The year was 1900. As Ms. Gremler's curriculum spread through Chile and beyond, it brought football to young women throughout the south of South America. You might think that this is kind of incredible or improbable. Women playing football in South America before it had even really caught on in England. And it did surprise me a bit. But think about it for a minute. The normal school graduates were somewhat unique wherever they went. Lawyers, judges, doctors, mayors, the leaders of all the institutions were men. But the normal school graduates were known to be authorities on just about everything. They were good at public speaking and debate. They would often be the only women in town who were authority figures. And even a doctor or a judge might be wary of arguing too much with them because while those men were well educated in their one subject, the normal school grads were educated in everything. Critics might object to some part of the school or the curriculum, but if they argue too hard, the normal school grads could out-argue them and maybe even make them look like fools. When the students started favoring football, many people objected. But a normal school grad could always defend the women playing football. So while Mrs. Gremler's curriculum didn't specifically say football, the physical education part often did become football. And as I said, this spread throughout the south of South America. By 1919, women's football was common in Chile. On May 11th, women's teams formed a women's football association. An article in the Mercurio newspaper describes teams that the paper is already familiar with, implying that the women had been playing for a while and that it was both commonplace and non-controversial. Another article about an exhibition match during an event with an air show and a motorcycle race says the women will not be playing in front of their usual crowds, which means they were usually drawing crowds. There were certainly critics in the press, but the women of Chile just ignored them. In 1927, sportswomen founded the Asociación Deportiva Femenina, or Women's Sports Association, in Valparaiso, Chile. While they didn't play football, the secretary of the ADF was interviewed and had this to say. Men have the idea that we cannot manage without them, but we are going to prove otherwise. She also mentioned that the ADF was founded to celebrate the 50th anniversary of a Chilean law that opened university education to women. And after 50 years, Chilean women like their sports. Generations of them had already gone through schools that supported girls and women's sports. No one was going to stop them. When the women graduated from school, they still continued to play. But now, without the support of the school, things were different. Women needed new support to play. So, they joined athletic clubs or labor unions. Sounds a little strange, maybe. These women were now working, and many jobs had labor unions. But unions are maybe a bit different or more elaborate than what you think of today. And the same for athletic clubs. Remember, there's no TV or radio at the time. So these organizations bought buildings, they hosted events, and had many other activities. Whether it was a union or a club, these organizations were controlled by dues-paying members and were generally governed democratically by those members. At most unions and clubs, all members were equal, men and women. They had committees on whatever they wanted to talk about, whether it was members' health or working conditions or tennis or soccer. And they had money to buy pitches. They had organization and infrastructure. They were almost like city-states. People lived their lives through and with their club or union. In a country where the rich and powerful were out of touch and perhaps not likely to listen to the needs of the people, these clubs and unions were the people. If there was no doctor in town, they had resources to bring one in. If the roads were in bad shape, they could fix them together. There was a place for everyone, and something for everyone to do. Especially through these unions and clubs, women's soccer spread through all of Chile. Of course, there were critics. All the usual comments about football not being a sport for women in the papers. But because these players were organized, because a club was much more than a team, the women could continue to play because they had the support of a whole community. Weirdly, the biggest threat to women's football in Chile from the 30s to the 50s isn't bad press or lack of fans or misogynists. The biggest threat to women's football is women's basketball. In the 40s and early 50s, Chilean women flocked to basketball. The teams are smaller than the soccer team. The action is fast. It can be played indoors. But possibly the biggest factor, thanks in part to positive press coverage of women's Olympic basketball, basketball is more socially acceptable. And remember Alice Miat here. She lobbied the Olympics for years to include more women's sports at the Olympics. And with the rise of the automobile, you can fit an entire basketball team in a single car. Which means that these women can travel further for games, and they can see more of their country and the world. But the popularity of women's basketball ends up helping women's football. In the 50s and 60s, because basketball is so popular, men start taking over the women's basketball teams. Some of these men think women shouldn't be playing any sports. Some are even openly hostile to the players. So with these hostile men in charge of women's basketball in Chile, women begin to leave the sport. And while women never stopped playing football, in the 1960s, women's football sees more growth. In 1971, they hear about the FIFE Women's World Cup in Mexico and are keen to send a team. For some reason, they never did. But women's football in Chile continues. When FIFA announces that they will hold a Women's World Cup in 1991, Chile finally forms a national team and plays their first officially recognized match in April of 1991. In 1999, Chile forms the National First Division Championship League and a second division with between 16 and 18 teams. The players aren't really paid, but they do have a league. Unlike many countries, in Chile, women never stopped playing once they started. Sexism and critics and neglect certainly suppressed women's football, but never succeeded in eliminating it. In the FIFA era, since FIFA began recognizing women's football, in many places, FIFA and various national football associations have ignored women. In Chile, it was bad. Over the last 30 years, Chile's FA gave Chilean women pretty much nothing. Uniforms were handed down from men's players, no resources. In 2016, disaster. FIFA kicked Chile off its international rankings, saying they had no way to rank Chile's team, because Chile, or their FA, hadn't scheduled a women's match in more than 2 years. Iona Rothfeld had played on Chile's national team for 10 years. When she heard the team had lost its ranking, she was angry. The Chilean FA didn't seem to care. Iona Rothfeld was having none of that. She founded the National Association of Women Soccer Players, or its Spanish acronym, ANJOF. ANJOF and Rothfeld began knocking on doors. The FA, teams, the government, anyone who would listen. And eventually they did. Chile's FA hired people to support and administer the women's game. Within a year, Chile hosted the women's Copa America and placed second, losing only to Brazil. Iona Rothfeld, along with her players' association, essentially shamed the Chilean FA into supporting the women's team. The national stadium now has a locker room purpose-built for Chile's women's team. In 2019, Chile made it to its first Women's World Cup. It's amazing what just a tiny investment into women's football can do. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to leave a review where you listen, share the show with your friends, and follow the show on Twitter at ForgottenXI. I'll see you next time.